So I travel on Friday, but I will be available via email, you know, to answer any questions. I'll be assigning more homework. Hopefully y'all all got the message that today the homework that was due today is now due tomorrow. Right? You got the 24-hour grace period. Thanks to one of your fellow classmates speaking up in class on Monday and asking for an extension. I'm going to go over some problems that are actually related to the homework. So you get the additional bonus of being here, of at least seeing things that are very much like some of the homework problems worked out. So happy birthday. Who here knows who Burt Lancaster is? God, you people are young. Famous actor. Who here knows who Marie Antoinette is? Okay, I'm not even that old. I'm close, but not quite. Katie Lang, famous, fabulous singer, rather gender flexible as well, and a great icon for the gender fluidity movement. David Schwimmer, who here is a Friends fan, who here has ever heard of Friends, the television show. And Richard Taylor, none of you have ever heard of him. However, he is another famous physicist who won a Nobel Prize somewhere back there. Today is National Deviled Egg Day, so you're going to see deviled eggs kind of throughout the lecture because I happen to love deviled eggs. And it's All Souls Day, the day after the day after Halloween. So, hey, homework's extended. Just as a reminder, right? You know that same stuff. I'm going to do some review before we get to equilibrium and statics again. I have the feeling some people didn't come to class today because they're already taking statics. And in the regular statics course, hopefully you've already seen rotational as well as translational equilibrium. But I'm going to review also some other things, assuming that the clicker ever works. Oh no! I guess I got to do it the old-fashioned way. I guess I can't even do it the old-fashioned way now. There we go. Let's see. So in terms of the third midterm, I'll probably actually have to give you multiple sheets of cheat sheets, because even just this section, the cheat sheet is already this horrible, right? I mean, it feels like we covered a lot of material. In some sense, what we've done is we've really taken almost everything that we've known and discovered and learned throughout the course of the semester before rotational motion, and then applied it to rotational motion as well. So this table is kind of the one-to-one mapping left and right of linear stuff or translational stuff on the left, things that we'd learned before in class, and then the corresponding angular quantities on the right. So linear momentum and angular momentum, linear kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, and rotational kinetic energy, 1/2 I omega squared, how mass translates to moment of inertia. That's the equivalent of mass for rotating things. And then, of course, all of the kinematics stuff, right? The regular linear kinematics, and then angular kinematics that comprises probably a good third to half of the homework that you do tomorrow. I included a little diagram in here, and I'll go over that diagram again later on in the lecture as I work through an example and point it out. This little diagram here with the circle makes some equivalencies between how far you move around the circle and how far you move in a corresponding straight line. For example, if this is a rope wrapped around that axle or around that circle, as you unspool the rope, the amount of rope that you unspool corresponds to r theta in terms of the distance that you had to wrap that same rope around that cylinder, around that circle, whatever it is. And the same relationships go on with angular and linear velocity and angular and linear acceleration. So we'll work through a few examples. I've got a few slides that do that, and then I'll do some things on the board as well. So this is all kind of review right now, and we'll go through some applications as well. So combining linear and angular motion is generally considered to be the hard part of this, where you have something unspooling, like the bucket hanging from a cylinder hanging over a well. So you've got something moving in a straight line and something turning as well. I'll rework that problem again just to show you all the steps and talk through the narrative of that. A ball or a cylinder rolling down a plane is another example. It's something that has both rolling components and linear components. So here's the recipe, right? And I try and give you recipes for problem solving. And it's very similar to the recipes you've seen before. Draw the picture, draw the vectors, decompose the vectors if you have to into whatever coordinate system you're working in. Sometimes we'll go into an example in a little bit with a ball rolling down an inclined plane. And Lord knows, whenever you're working with an inclined plane, you know you're going to have to decompose the force of gravity into the force down the plane and the force perpendicular to the plane. It's just how it works. It's a standard technique for that kind of thing. So once you have the picture, and once you have all the forces, you've done a lot of the setup of the problem, and then you have to apply Newton's second law, right? F equals ma, F net equals ma, or the net torque is equal to I alpha, the angular acceleration as well. And you really do have to be, just like before, just like always, you have to be very careful about signs when you do that, and make sure that you're adding together the forces so that if the forces are pointing in opposite directions, they have opposite signs. The same goes for the torques, the same goes for the angular accelerations, linear accelerations, etc. So in a following problem, I'll show, when these things are connected, like the bucket pulling a rope that's wrapped around something that's turning, well, that rope is pulling the same distance as it's being pulled off of the cylinder that it's wrapped around, right? So those two motions are connected through the rope. If I move this many meters in the bucket, well, that means I had to unroll that many meters of rope around the edge of the cylinder. So when the two are connected, at least, you have to use these equations. You have to remember to relate the linear and rotational things, whether it's acceleration, whether it's distance and angle, whether it's angular velocity and linear velocity, relate them all through the radius of the thing, the circular motion object being wrapped around there. And so that little picture is a little mnemonic, and I'll include it on the cheat sheets as well. But once you write down all the equations, pretty much, as I keep on saying, physics is done. That's it. That's all the setup, and all the rest, however painful it may be, is algebra. And identify all of your unknowns, and you better have n equations for your n unknowns. And you may feel like you have lots of equations and lots of unknowns, but oftentimes many of those will be relatively simple to calculate, certainly for the types of problems you're facing here. All of physics really is like n equations and unknowns. All of physics really is, everything is connected, and somehow you have enough constraints in the world to determine all of your unknowns, certainly in these types of problems. So here's the bucket problem again. I flashed up just one slide last time that had the solution and talked through it briefly, but I want to take this recipe and I want to show you how this recipe is applied to a problem like this, where linear and angular motion are connected through, in this case, a rope or a line, something that connects the linear motion of the bucket to the rotational motion of the cylinder that's on top of the well. So So we're also moving into an era where I'm not going to work with numbers much anymore. The numbers you can plug in, we've practiced that plenty, and I don't want to spend a lot of time in class plugging things into calculators. So we've got a bucket of a certain mass, and I take the cylinder on this above this well, and I wrap my rope around it and attach this bucket. Let's say I put some rocks in the bucket, whatever it is, the bucket has a significant mass, lowercase m, and I attach it to a cylinder of a bigger mass, so it's got some inertia. As soon as I talk about that cylinder having a specific mass, I expect you to use moment of inertia and understand that that thing is going to resist being turned, just like the bucket is going to have some inertia against acceleration as well. So now we start this all from rest and we drop the bucket. How fast does the bucket go? Now, if the rope wasn't there, the bucket would accelerate at the acceleration of gravity. It would free fall. But since the rope is there, you better expect that the bucket accelerates slower than the acceleration of gravity, because there's extra tension in the rope counteracting the force of gravity and keeping the bucket from falling that fast or accelerating that fast. So even at the very outset, prepare your mind and think, okay, whatever number I come up with better be less than g. Better have the same units as g. And in fact, I also probably expect that the final answer I get is going to be proportional to the acceleration of gravity, because if I do this experiment in outer space, the bucket ain't going anywhere. If I do this experiment on the moon, it accelerates less, and if I do it on Jupiter, it accelerates more, right? So the units I get for acceleration are probably going to be in g's anyway. So start off drawing the free body diagram. Start off drawing little boxes and isolating the important elements of the problem and drawing their forces, and using a coordinate system for them as well, right? So here I arbitrarily drew down as positive. It doesn't have to be that way, that's just how I picked it, because down being positive also means that this is a positive turn of the cylinder, as I'm going to define. So I have to be careful about the signs as they relate to the rotation as well as the translation. And there's two forces acting on the bucket. Just force of gravity. Gravity is a force. And the tension of the rope pulling up, counteracting gravity. Simple enough. And then the cylinder has one force acting on it, which is the tension of the rope. I didn't say so here, but in almost all the problems you'll get an extra phrase in there that says ignore friction. I could say there's some friction of the axle and make the problem even harder. Let's not do that right now. Let's just keep this at one force acting on the cylinder to turn it, and that's the tension of the rope. And these two tensions are the same. You could draw a third free body object in here, by the way, which is a piece of the rope, right? And a piece of the rope carries the tensions. That's the only thing you get out of that is understanding that this tension pulling up on the bucket is the same as this tension pulling down on the edge of this cylinder. And that you've got enough experience in that you can almost skip that step. Okay. So free body diagrams are drawn, signs have been careful about, and now we write down Newton's laws. And we have to be careful about the signs here too. So in the linear, for the linear motion for the bucket, F net is equal to, well, positive is gravity and negative is the tension, so mg minus t. And F net is equal to ma. And be careful now, by writing MA here, I'm already kind of putting into the problem my knowledge that the thing accelerates down, right? I put in an MA being positive, going down. That's partly why I picked that sign convention, just to make it easy and avoid that problem, avoid that potential step. And for the cylinder, the sum of the torques has to equal I alpha. just Newton's second law for rotating stuff. That's it. So I've got Newton's second law applied to each one of these. Now for the cylinder, I can work through all the stuff, right? I can write down, look up what's the moment of inertia of the cylinder. 1/2 times the mass times the radius squared. What's the definition of torque here for this force acting at this radius? It's the tension times the radius times the sine of the angle between them, which is 90 degrees. So it's just the tension times the radius. You're pulling exactly perpendicular to the radius at the edge. And also, I wrote down that handy little A equals alpha R thing, right? Coming back from this slide, A equals R alpha, or alpha equals A over R, alpha equals A over R, to connect the linear and angular motion stuff. So I can take all of those and I can plug them into Newton's second law here. The torque, the only torque is TR, the tension times the radius. The moment of inertia is 1/2 mR squared. And now that alpha is A over R. And I can cancel out all the R's. There are all kinds of R's that all cancel out, it turns out. Shockingly enough, the tension doesn't depend on the radius of the cylinder. That's already kind of cool. It's not necessarily something you would naively expect, but it turns out to work. And so the tension and the acceleration, two things that I don't know, are related this way. I know the mass of the cylinder, but I don't know the acceleration or tension. One equation, two unknowns. I guess I'm not done yet. I guess I need the linear motion too. So work this through now with the linear motion. I can take this tension and plug it in and eliminate T. So I put in an MA over 2 up here, and I solve this equation for A, the acceleration. And I get a nice little equation for the acceleration of this thing dropping attached to that cylinder. Do not, during an exam, come back to this slide and go, oh yeah, I remember that formula. Take all my numbers and just plug and chug, right? Unless it's the exact same problem, it's going to be a different formula. If that was a sphere, it's a different formula. If that's a hollow cylinder, it's a different formula, right? Because the moment of inertia is different. Don't think of this as universal. Just think of this as an answer for this particular problem. And concentrate not on the answer, but the process of getting there. Because the process, following that formula, following that recipe, is more important than the cake. The cake is a lie. So here, does this follow my intuition? Does this follow my expectation? Is that A, for masses that are greater than zero, is that A less than G? Come on. Yeah, okay. I've got a little M on top, and I've got a little M plus something on the bottom. So gosh, you know, that ratio of little M over little M plus something, the extra mass on the bottom, is got to be less than 1. If, in fact, this cylinder is completely massless, if capital M is 0, this thing reduces to this thing being in free fall. It's got no tension. It doesn't have to exert any tension to turn the thing up there. It's a bucket and a rope free falling. So it reduces to that quite naturally if the mass of the cylinder is 0. The mass of the bucket is 0. Reduces to 0 because, gosh, there's no gravity on the bucket to pull it because there's no mass to the bucket. So kind of all of the, you know, if you think about it and play with the numbers for various extremes, it fits your intuition. Okay? So this is not quite one of your homework problems, this one is. Okay? The same setup. Bucket hanging on the string, hanging on the rope, unwinding, and going down a well. And now let's say the well is a certain depth, whatever depth it is. And now the question is, how fast is the bucket moving when it hits the bottom? Let's say Timmy is down there and I'm lowering the bucket to save Timmy, because Lassie came and told me that Timmy was stuck at the bottom of the well. And gosh, I don't want to bonk Timmy on the head too hard with the bucket full of rocks I'm lowering down to save him. So, there are a couple of ways to do this one, right? You just did some stuff that was a kinematic approach. In some sense, you've already reduced this problem to your regular old linear kinematics. One way to do this is to use that previous result. We figured out the acceleration, and it's constant. Mass is not changing. And I know it started from rest, and so I can use one of my linear kinematics equations and solve it fairly quickly and get the velocity that I end up with. Okay, that v0 is 0. I take this square root, and I put this in for the acceleration. It looks kind of complicated, but it's actually pretty straightforward. That's applying your regular old linear kinematics to this problem and solving it. And the hard part was actually not the linear kinematics here. The hard part was all of this mess calculating the acceleration of the bucket as it falls. So that's one way to get the answer of how fast the bucket is moving when it hits the bottom of the well. What's another way that doesn't involve kinematics? What else have you learned about? Huh? Speak up. I'm old.
Conservation of energy.
Good, of course, right? So you've got an initial gravitational potential energy for the bucket, and all of that is getting converted to kinetic energy of the bucket at the bottom. But now the cylinder is rotating too, so it's actually two kinetic energies. All that gravitational potential energy is getting converted to kinetic energy of the bucket and the kinetic energy of the cylinder, of the winch at the top. And they better end up with the same answer. So let's, you know, work through that, right? This is a quick slide here. The initial energy of the system is all just potential energy. The thing is not moving before you let the winch go. And the potential energy is only the mass of the bucket times g times the height that it's going to drop. And setting y equals 0 at the bottom of the well. So the final energy, well, bucket's at the bottom of the well, it doesn't have any potential energy anymore. But boy gosh, it's moving. Timmy, watch out. It puts the lotion in the bucket or it gets the hose again. And so what you've got is you've got kinetic energy of the bucket and kinetic energy of the cylinder. 1/2 mv². Go back and look in your cheat sheet. What's kinetic energy rotating? 1/2 I ω². For the cylinder, okay, this is the moment of inertia. And now, gosh, I need to convert this thing to a linear velocity to match this linear velocity here. And those two are connected through the way the rope is wrapped around the cylinder. So I've got that I ω², if I combine these things, actually ends up being a 1/2 mv². 1/2 mv². And so combine all those things together, I end up with the final energy being this kind of little complicated thing, right? 1/2 the velocity squared I factored out, and I ended up with the mass of the bucket plus 1/2 the mass of the cylinder. These two energies have to be equal. Conservation of energy. So I set those two things equal, and I solve for V. Divide by all of that stuff, multiply by the 2 on top, and take a square root. 2mgd over m plus 1 half capital M. What was it back here? 2mgd over m plus 1 half capital M. I end up getting the same result both ways. Whichever way you want to do it is fine as long as you are systematic and explain your work. The conservation of energy and kinematics both give you the same answer, which is great, thank heavens, because if they didn't, then we'd have a problem. And whichever one is easier for you to use, whichever one makes more sense to you, use that one. Unless I explicitly tell you, thou shalt use conservation of energy to solve this problem. Thou shalt use kinematics to solve this problem. The real world generally does not say, thou shalt use this technique to solve this problem. All it says is, hey, you gotta build a robot and make sure the robot doesn't fall over. Or you gotta have this winch and make sure you don't crack Timmy in the head at the bottom of the well too fast. Build it with your engineers. So whichever technique you want to use is fine, but there are multiple approaches to do this. Personally, I generally find that people, including me, make the fewest mistakes using conservation of energy. Because it is much, much harder to get signs wrong. And it is very easy to get signs wrong if you accidentally, you know, have this pointing up, but you have the acceleration in the wrong direction here, you're going to end up getting a minus sign down here, and things are going to get weird and confusing. And sometimes applying Newton's laws, unless you're very careful about all of your signs, can get you in a real tangle. While conservation of energy is 2-column, 3-column accounting. Add together a bunch of positive things, and they better add up before and after. Now you got to be careful about accommodating all of those. You got to be careful about not forgetting one of the kinetic energies at the end, or including the force. If there's friction, then things get complicated too, and you got to be careful about that energy. But for the most part, conservation of energy, because it's a scalar, is so much easier to use. Any questions so far on this? Because, as they say, stuff's about to get real, okay? So with that set up, this is a pretty simple application of that recipe of combining linear and angular motion. Because the axle of the thing that's turning is not moving. And I've got a bucket that's moving, and I unroll the rope, unspool the rope, and it's pretty clear that the translational and the rotational motion are connected by the rope. Now we're going to do something a little bit more fun. And this is, now we're going to do a classic inclined plane problem with your thing, whatever it is, right? We used to have just a block sliding down a frictionless plane. Well, now we're going to have a sphere rolling down an inclined plane. If there's no friction, what happens? It just slides, okay? If there's no friction at all, this looks just like the block sliding down the plane because there's no friction to make the thing turn. There's no friction to apply a torque to that ball to make it turn. So instead, what I do is I write a little problem that says, consider this thing rolling down a plane without slipping. So it's got friction. It's got enough friction that the thing doesn't skid or turn. I mean, doesn't slide against the surface of the plane. So now we want to ask, what is this thing's linear acceleration down the plane? In some ways, it's kind of like, It's actually in some ways rather similar to the bucket, because if there were no friction, this thing would slide down the plane, you know, G sine theta is the acceleration. You can calculate it from the force pretty quickly. But because now some energy is not just going into making the thing accelerate, but making the thing turn, you should expect that the ball accelerates down the plane less than G sine theta, okay? As an acceleration less than if there were no friction at all. So if you want to get something going down the plane really fast, really grease up the plane and make sure there's no friction and just slide it. Because any energy that goes into rotating the thing is energy that's lost from the kinetic energy of the thing moving, right? And it doesn't accelerate nearly as fast. First things first, follow the recipe. First part of the recipe, draw a free body diagram, right? Draw a picture. Dr. Todd always loves his pictures, okay? So zeroth order, it's an inclined plane, you know. Draw an inclined plane. Zeroth order, you know. Decompose the force of gravity into the force along the plane and the force perpendicular to the plane. And there's a normal force, okay. That's fine. And this is stuff that hopefully you knew how to do in the third week of class or whatever it was. But now there's one other force, right? Remember, the thing goes down the plane without slipping. So there's a force of friction. And the force of friction, before we kind of just generally said, oh, the friction just kind of pushes up the plane wherever. But now it matters where the friction is applied, because if the friction is applied in the center, the thing doesn't turn. Well, you know it turns. The friction has got to be applied where the thing contacts the plane. Right? And that makes sense. That makes you happy. So now this is the force diagram of how this thing looks. And these are all the forces acting on that sphere, that bowling ball or whatever it is, rolling down a plane. And the force of friction is definitely pushing at a different location than the component of gravity pulling the thing down the plane. Now you can, you know, if you're just looking at the linear motion, okay, let's write down the linear motion. Because remember, for these things, you have to write down the linear motion and the angular motion. Angular motion is a little bit more complicated first. Just write down the horizontal, the linear components acting down the plane. F net is equal to ma. Well, there's a force of gravity pulling the thing down. And just looking at forces pushing up or down, the force of friction points up. Yeah, it points in a different spot. That makes a difference for the rotating part. But it is an effective force still pushing up on the object, and you have to include it in the linear equations. Right? So in the regular Newton's second law, working in a straight line. So this is just like the bucket with the tension and gravity. This is now the ball with gravity and with, quote unquote, you know, friction supplying the role of tension in a supporting role. And F equals ma. That's it. Okay? For the rotating stuff, you have to pick an axis. And because you get that freedom to choose, I can also tell you it doesn't matter. Physics doesn't care about your choice of where the axis of rotation is. I could write rotational, you know, equations of this sphere, quote unquote, you know, kind of rotating around some point way up here or way down here or way over here. I could pick an axis wherever. By God, the math would be really painful. But I can assure you that after you got through three pages of algebra, you'd end up with the same answer. as if you picked a kind of natural axis, which is the center of the object. Okay? And the natural pick for the center of the object is also kind of natural because
you can look it up so easily.
And you'd have to use the parallel axis theorem if it was somewhere else. And that would just be a pain. And you know that as this thing is rotating, it kind of looks like it's rotating around the center. So let's pick the center and write down Newton's second law from an angular sphere. For a solid sphere, the moment of inertia is 2/5 mr squared. You know the acceleration and the angular acceleration here of this thing rotating down are related that way again. And now this torque, the torque produced by this force of friction is that's at 90 degrees with respect to the radius. So it's just the force of friction times the radius is the torque, is equal to I alpha.
F equals ma.
Again, plug, chug, work through. And you find that the two unknowns, the force of friction and the acceleration, are related by this handy equation. If this was a cylinder, instead of 2/5, this would be 1/2. If this was a ring rolling down, instead of 2/5, this would be 1. Because that 2/5 completely comes from the moment of inertia of whatever object it is that's rolling. Okay? Now, physics is done. Two equations, two unknowns. Yep. That is torque. Right, that torque net equals force of friction times R. No tension in this problem, but yes, that's a tau, is that Greek letter. For y'all Greek folks. So now, you know, you can say physics is done again, right? Two equations, two unknowns, solve them. So I can take that and that. I can plug them together. What I do is I take that force of friction and plug it in there. I cross out the m's because all of the masses cancel out. And then I solve for a and I end up getting an acceleration that's 5/7 g sine theta. If this thing was just sliding, the acceleration would be g sine theta, but this is less. Well, makes sense. Okay? But you have to calculate it from combining both the sliding and rotational forces acting on the object. So far, so good. And all this is applying that same recipe yet again. Draw all the forces, decompose the vectors, write down Newton's laws, solve. And it feels good. Now, if this moment of inertia, you know, was much, much larger, let's say the moment of inertia is, you know, all of mr squared, then what I get over here is I get an ma here, I get 2ma over here, and I'd actually end up at the limiting case, which is 1/2 g sine theta. So if this is actually a cylinder, what's taking place is kind of half of the acceleration is going into turning the thing, half of the acceleration is going into accelerating the thing down the plane, half of the total energy. So let's do one more and then go back to, let's go back to the last class. Because I did some work in the last class on a board and got a little bit tangled up. And I want to make sure that we got this one straight. And also it's steeply related to this ball and inclined plane thing, where the ball is sliding down. Well, a ball sliding down an inclined plane reminds me of the loop-de-loop problem too. And I did the loop-de-loop problem last class. And I posted it in the slide. This is a post of the workout of that problem now in detail and getting the right answer. when I had accidentally forgotten the gravitational potential energy of the ball up at the top of the ramp. So now I've got a solid marble or a solid ball. Moment of inertia is 2/5 mr squared. And I'm rolling it from a height without slipping through a loop-de-loop. And what's the minimum height it takes to make it through this loop-de-loop? And now I'm doing the full table of conservation of energy. Where at the top of the ramp, all I've got is gravitational potential energy. And as I get to the top of the ramp there, I'm moving, so I've got kinetic energy. I'm rolling, so I've got rolling kinetic energy. And I've got some gravitational potential energy because I'm at the top of the loop, right? mg2r, that is the height above the bottom here. So using the full conservation of energy and working through all of the algebra that ends up being involved between this conservation of energy equation, I end up having to launch the thing from 2/7 of the radius of the loop. 2.7 times the radius of the loop. Before it was 2 or 2.5, depending on how you looked at things. And there is a link in this and the slides and the class notes to the nice little MIT video where they experimentally demonstrate, yes, in fact, if I roll a marble from 2.7, the radius of the loop, it does, in fact, just barely make it through. And they end up with the same number, 2.7. So that's a magic number. And that's the number if this thing is a solid sphere. And if it was a ring, it would be different. If it was a cylinder, it would be different. But you have all the tools to calculate that. So if it's here's a question to you that you have to wake up and actually think about. This is the case for a sphere. If this thing instead is a hoop with all of its mass around the edge, okay, do I have to roll it from higher or lower to make it through the loop? Higher, okay. It's going to end up containing more energy and kinetic energy of rotation because it's got more mass at a further distance from the center. So I have to add that energy in at the beginning by launching it from a higher point. So your gut tells you the correct thing so far. So far, so good. Phew. I just had to take a break or take a breather. There is, last class we talked a lot about gyroscopes. I don't think I gave you any gyroscopes or serious angular momentum conservation homework. Although, as engineers in particular, I mean, you've got effectively nanogyroscopes right here in your pocket or on the table. Right? There's a gyroscope in your cell phone in one of the chips. Gyroscopes are used for all sorts of inertial guidance for missiles, for all sorts of inertial guidance for satellites and things like that. Conservation of angular momentum, a lot of you will apply a lot later on in life. I don't want to get too tangled in it because at this level, gyroscopes and conservation of angular momentum is a very, very three-dimensional problem. What I instead want to do is, because a lot of you are cities and a lot of you are mechies, let's move forward and go into equilibrium and statics and start working through equilibrium and statics problems. And then when Balsha comes in, Dr. Terzic comes in on Monday, he'll talk about stress, strain, deformation, all of the physics terms that we actually use to describe how solids deform under the external forces that we have, how things stretch, how things shear. So the rest of this lecture is the equilibrium and statics part of the class, and this is another chapter at least. So we're shifting gears, but we're still using a
essentially the same recipe. It's just a simpler recipe, just like we did before. Right?
We had systems where we drew the picture of all the forces and then say, some of the forces is equal to zero because there's no acceleration. And quite often, the things weren't even moving. They were static. That's why it's called static. And then now we've got rotating systems as well. And we've got to consider systems that are not just in equilibrium under external forces that are pointing through their centers of mass, but systems that are in equilibrium with external forces that are trying to turn them. And so now we've got to apply an additional constraint, which is the sum of the torques is equal to zero, as well as the sum of the forces are equal to zero. Classic example of this, everybody's favorite, is a mobile, right? You got the mobile hanging from the ceiling with all kinds of things hanging off the edges, and everything is balanced against each other. That's certainly rotational equilibrium. If you take something off, the thing pivots around the support point because you upset the rotational equilibrium of the system. So a few pictures from the textbook, from the class slides of the textbook, you know, just to illustrate the point. So if I've got now an object that has some physical extent, this is some cylinder, some sphere, whatever it is, it's got some force acting on its center and then two supports on either side pulling it back up. Well, one of the supports is trying to rotate it clockwise, one is trying to rotate it counterclockwise around the center. But as long as those two forces balance out the force acting down, I've got the net force is equal to zero, right? The body is not accelerating linearly up or down. And this torque counteracts this torque from these two forces. So I've got the net torque around, and this downward force acting through the object's center of mass is no torque at all, because there's no radius, no lever arm. So this object is in equilibrium, is in static equilibrium. It won't turn, it won't accelerate off into any direction. However, if I've got an axle here, okay, so this is some cylinder that's perhaps the axle of a motor, and you can imagine that there are forces being applied to make that thing turn, like a wheel, for example, or an axle. And then, yes, there's no net linear force. The total net linear force up and down here is zero, so thank heavens the axle isn't flying out of your motor or whatever. The center of mass of the object is not accelerating vertically. But there is a net torque, right? Both of these torques act now in the same direction to turn this object clockwise. And so that thing is not in equilibrium. And certainly you can imagine if there's some object floating around that has multiple forces acting against an axis in multiple ways, that completely unbalanced, now you've really got a system that is, okay, it'll move off in that distance, but here actually these torques both compensate each other, right? This force over this radius and this twice the force over half the radius, both of those torques cancel each other out. And you've got no net rotation, but sure enough, that object is going to take off upward. And linearly accelerate. So set up, you know, follow the same recipe. Draw the free body diagram. Use the sum of the forces and sum of the torques is equal to zero. Choose whatever reference point you want to compute the torques. Almost always for you guys, that reference point, I'll even add it into the slide because it's pretty much almost always this point is the center of mass of the object. Right? That just makes it easier to compute a lot of things, including a moment of inertia of the object that might be turned. And then execute the solution and evaluate things. Think about it. So classic example is hanging a sign from the side of a building. You've seen this, you know, similarly to your statics class. Okay, here you're advertising deviled eggs and deviled egg day. And evaluate now, what are the forces acting on this rod? Because there are forces attempting to turn or move or accelerate that rod. If that rod wasn't attached to the building at all, it would fall, it would rotate, it would execute all kinds of complicated motion. So sure enough, when I attach that rod to the building, I better have some way of supporting it so that this rod does not accelerate downward based on the weight, the tension in this line from the weight of the sign. So there must be some net upward force from the building. And then, also, okay, well, if there's net upward force, you know, I could pick any rotational axis I want here. Gosh, this gets a little bit complicated now, because if I pick this center of rotation at the center of mass of the bar, sure, it looks like the upward force from the building that keeps the thing from falling also is helping the thing turn. Whoops, you gonna live? Yeah. Sorry. Don't die in my class, please. I mean, you can die inside, everybody does, but don't die overtly. There's, so you can pick another torque point, which is a torque, you know, if I attach this thing with some glue here, certainly it's going to stay attached to the building, but it's going to fall. It feels like the natural pivot point is the point of attachment to the building, so I put a little blue dot there. Calculated the net torque from the weight of the sign, but gosh, whatever's supporting that thing is really going to have to exert some torque to counteract that. Quite a lot. The building torque is a very small radius to act. And this is generally, you know, why you don't just slap this thing onto the side of a building without additional support. So how do you do that? The classic way of doing it is to add some guy wire. Right, some additional tension, some additional force that pulls on this both upward to counteract the downward force and adds also a torque in the opposite direction to the torque produced by the weight of the object. And now I have to worry, since this guy wire is now acting at an angle, I have to decompose the vectors, right? Cosines, sines. I have to look at all the vectors and draw my free body diagrams with tension times the cosine and the sine. So here I did that. Right? The total horizontal forces acting on the rod. There's a force pushing out from the building. And you'd expect that, because how do I know it's pushing out? It's because if I take the building away, the rod's going to move left. So I kind of can pretty well suspect and guess that the force from the building is pushing out on the rod. And then there's a tension, a horizontal component of this tension, pushing into the building horizontally. Force from the sign is all vertical. Forget about it here. This is just the horizontal forces. And then the vertical forces acting on the rod. There's some support, perhaps, from the building on this side of the rod. There's a component of tension acting up here, and there's the weight of the sign acting down here. So you draw a free body diagram now with the real locations of the vectors, not just pointing through the center of mass like you did before, but now it's almost like a real two- or three-dimensional sketch. And the torque's acting on the thing. Let's say that I choose a pivot point at the building so I don't have to worry about torques being applied by those building forces, which I don't know and are complicated. So let's make the pivot point there. And this is a standard trick for these types of problems. Pick a pivot point to eliminate at least one unknown. Here I picked a pivot point to eliminate two unknowns. In the equation I get out of this, the horizontal and vertical components of the building don't act anymore because they're acting straight through the pivot point, so they apply no torque. So select a pivot point that makes sense, and then look at the components that provide torque here. This torque and this tension is T times sine theta. Both of these are acting at the radius of that rod, that total distance, that total length. And then the mass of the object or the weight of the object is acting as well. And you get the signs right here, right? One is acting clockwise, one is acting counterclockwise, so they're equal and opposite. Something a little funny comes out of this equation, actually, it turns out, right? So here, if I set that total torque equal to zero, I get mg is equal to t sine theta. In the vertical case, mg is equal to t sine theta. If mg is equal to t sine theta here, what's the vertical force from the building? It's zero. The building doesn't actually have to apply any force. I could have a frictionless surface on the building, for all I know, and still make this thing barely work. It'll be pretty unstable. If I breathe on it the wrong way, it'll slip. But at least the statics demonstrate that the equations actually work out so that the only force applied from the building here to keep this rod stationary where it is a force pushing straight out. That's not completely obvious from looking at it unless you apply the equations. And so I can take these three equations and solve them for the tension in the line. In fact, I can just solve that from the torque already, and then I can find the components of the building forces as well. The vertical component is zero, and the horizontal component is just t cosine theta to balance out the amount of tension pulling into the building from this line. So that's kind of a classic example there. This is a harder example, and this is an example that is going to take a little while of the class to work through. Because this is kind of a classic good homework problem, or even a hard test problem, where now you've got to deal with lots and lots of different forces. So you got a guy climbing up a ladder. He's planted a ladder on the ground, and he's climbing up the ladder, and he stands up partway up the ladder. Now, if there's no friction on the ground, that ladder is going to kick out from underneath him, as anybody that's worked on a roof or clean gutters knows. Okay? Let's assume that, let's not worry about friction from the wall. We just kind of did another problem with the sign where it was pretty clear that the vertical forces from the wall as you put this thing on the wall don't really matter that much. But the wall is going to push out. Okay? So you got lots of forces acting on this ladder. You got the weight of the ladder, you got the weight of the guy, you got the forces on the ground at the bottom of the ladder, you got the force in the building at the top of the ladder. And the question is, okay, how much friction do I need at the bottom to be safe? An alternative version of this problem, which is in fact harder than this one, is given the coefficient of friction on the bottom, how close or far do I have to put the ladder to be safe? And then, as anybody knows, you put the ladder really flat, right, too shallow, you climb up the ladder, the bottom's going to kick out from underneath you. You're generating more torque to kick the bottom out. That's why you want to make the ladder, you know, almost as vertical as is possible, so that almost all of your weight acts straight down the ladder and becomes a normal force to help the friction. But here I've got a setup. And the setup is a bit like a movie problem. I've measured all these things. Now I ask, what's the coefficient of friction at the bottom that's necessary?
So let's
work through this one on the board, on a board. I was playing Eraser Jenga earlier. So this is the ladder in the wall. Problem. Well, I've got a wall here. I've got an angle theta of the ladder there. The center of mass of the ladder is basically at the center of the ladder. And now, let's see, let's say the mass of the ladder is ML. That's known. And the mass of the man, right? And we know the angle theta. So now I have to start drawing all sorts of forces. So this is the mass of the man times G. That's certainly acting down. This is the mass of the ladder times G. That's certainly acting down. There's a force acting, and these are forces on the ladder now, right? So drawing the forces on the ladder. So this is some force from the wall. We assume that the wall was frictionless. Friction would create a resistance against sliding this way. But otherwise, all we have to really worry about is the force of the wall pushing out. And then down here, which direction does the force point? It's hard, okay? In fact, you don't know it. And in fact, what you need to do is you need to kind of say, well, okay, there's certainly some normal force pushing up. Because if there wasn't, this ladder would certainly sink into the ground. But there's also a force of friction keeping the thing from sliding or kicking out one way or the other. And that force of friction, you know, if there's no friction here, that ladder will tend to slip out from underneath you that direction. So let's draw the force of friction that way. Okay? So these are the forces on the ladder. That's already kind of complicated. It's got a lot of bits and pieces to it. So we drew them, and that's good. Okay. So Newton, the linear Newton. So the net forces. This is a statics problem, so the net forces in the horizontal better equal zero. Ladder isn't moving. Let's draw a coordinate system so that we get the right signs. So there's positive force of friction pointing to the right.
There's the force from the wall pointing to the left. That's fine so far. There is in the y direction. Thank heavens this is not an inclined plane. I don't need to decompose vectors or anything like that. That's why this is a useful problem. This is also equal to zero because it's a statics problem. And we have the normal force minus the mass of the guy times g minus the mass of the ladder times g. Okay? So far, so good. So this gives me the force of friction is equal to the force from the wall. And this gives me the normal force is equal to the mass of the guy times plus the mass of the ladder times g. Both of these kind of make sense. You could almost guess them, but better to derive them. Two equations, how many unknowns? Okay, if I know the mass of the guy and the mass of the ladder in G, I've got three unknowns left. Force of friction, the normal force, and the force from the wall. Two equations, three unknowns, I need one more. And yes, I get that from torque. So let's do Newton angular as well. And that torques are equal to zero because this is a statics problem. Now we got to pick a rotational axis. Remember what I said about convenient ways to pick your rotational axis. You want to pick your rotational axis so that you eliminate as many unknowns as you can. Where should the rotational axis be on here? Where the ladder hits the ground, okay? If I put the rotational axis here, that normal force doesn't exert any torque because the right radius is zero. That force of friction doesn't exert any torque, okay? The only force that exerts any torque is this force from the wall, and then, of course, the two weights as well. So the net torque is the torque, and let's call this the positive direction here, positive direction there. So now I've got the torque from the man plus the torque from the ladder minus the torque from the wall. And I'll figure out those torques in a second because they're not trivial. Okay? Remember the definition of torque. Torque was equal to R cross F. Or working in magnitudes, R times F. Times, is it the sine or the cosine? Well, at zero, it's got to be zero. If two things are lined up, I don't apply any torque, so it's got to be the sine. Times the sine of the angle between them. And that's the angle between R and F. So let's figure out what this distance is. Okay. So L was the length of the ladder.
the problem.
I even forget what the problem said here.
I think the guy was standing a third of the way up the ladder. One third of the way up the ladder. So this distance was L over 3. And this distance here to the center of the ladder is L over 2.
Okay.
So, first one that's easiest to figure out is because this angle is theta down here, that angle is theta up there. Okay. And here we get into a few subtleties that I'll actually work through on a separate board, just to be sure. So for the torque of the wall, okay, is equal to that total length of the ladder times the force of the wall times the sine of the angle between the ladder and wall. This is the force of the wall. This direction is actually the direction that the radius points in. And this was theta. So that angle between R and the force of the wall is actually for this sine of 180 degrees minus theta, right? If that angle is theta, that angle between these two vectors better be 180 minus theta. So far, so good. Let me shorten that up here. This is theta here. A similar thing kind of applies now for the weight of the ladder. This is that distance, this is theta. Now the weight of the ladder as well. And this is also the mass of the ladder times g, right? So the torque of the ladder, this torque of the wall, by the way, is counterclockwise. This torque of the ladder is the radius, L over 2, times the force. The force is the mass of the ladder times g. Times the sine of the angle between them, which is again 180 degrees. Minus theta. And the torque from the man is equal to L over 3 times the mass of the man times g times the sine of 180 degrees minus theta. Okay? When you draw your pictures, you got to be real careful in figuring out torques of what exactly the angle is between the radius, which you draw out from the axis towards where the force is applied, and the force itself. And so I hope these diagrams, you know, help clarify that in this case, all of these torques end up with these angles. So far, so good.
So, what's the sign of, what does the sign look like? Well, the sign looks like this, right? Where this is 0, this is 180, and this is, then it goes back to 360. So I hope you can see that the sine of 180 degrees minus theta is equal to the sine of theta. Right? If I have theta here, it looks just like walking back from 180 degrees the same amount. I never memorize this kind of stuff, by the way. Other people might. I never do. I just draw the picture. And from the picture, I can kind of tell right away what the translation is. So now we have all of this, and we can go back and plug in these torques. So the net torque is equal to 0. The torque of the man is L over 3 times the man, the mass of the man times G times the sine of theta. The torque of the ladder is L over 2 times the mass of the ladder times G times the sine of theta. And then I subtract, because it's pointing in the other direction, the torque from the wall, which acts at a length of L, with the force from the wall, times sine of theta. Long and painful slog to see, that kind of L's cancel out, G's cancel out, sines of theta's cancel out. What I end up getting is one-third times the mass, the man, times G, plus one-half the mass, the ladder, times G. L's canceled out, and sine of theta canceled out. So this is the force of the wall. That's equal to 0. The force from the wall is one-third the mass, the man, plus one-half the mass of the ladder, all times G. Okay? After I set all this stuff up, look at that. Now I've got 3 equations with 1 unknown. Here, I just calculated out what the force of the wall is based on other things that were known. That gives me what the force of friction must be. Well, the force of friction, you remember, is also equal to the coefficient of friction times the normal force, and I know what the normal force is too. So from all of this, I can calculate what the coefficient of friction has to be for this entire thing to work and for Lancelot to be safe. Okay? This is about, in this class, this is close to as complicated and involved as these rotational equilibrium problems come. Because this is many forces acting at many radii with different angles. But all of the techniques are here. And in particular, the technique here that's new of being careful to always get the angle between the force and the radius right in these equations by drawing the picture, that's new to you. Everything else, again, is kind of algebra. There's one other thing I want to cover. I'll go back. In the class notes and the slides already, I already have some of the breakdown, but I'll include these boards at least, right? This is the breakdown of
all of the different forces that were involved, the normal force, the force of friction, the weights of both of the guys, and the normal force out from the wall. I'll include the full solution in the class notes here. But let's go back to one other thing that we did before. I forgot one board that I prepped, just because I wanted to clarify something. Yeah, McKenzie. Shouldn't, right? So because the sum of the torques is equal to zero, if I reverse all of the torques and reverse the sign of zero, okay. So as long the key is being consistent when you put in all of the torques, though, because if you accidentally flip one of them, it's not right anymore. You have to make sure that you flip the signs of everything when you do it that way. So the plus or minus. Physics doesn't care about whether you prefer clockwise or counterclockwise being positive, right? It shouldn't, at least. If it does, write the paper and go get your Nobel Prize because you've discovered something that violates the known experience of millions of years of your ancestors. There is, right, and so McKenzie was pointing out here I chose clockwise as being positive. While on this diagram, at least, counterclockwise is being labeled as positive. And as long as you do it consistently, it doesn't matter. So going back, and then I'll let you guys out a little bit early because we didn't have a good break in here, at least. We did the ball in inclined plane, and it may look like, gosh, I didn't really see a problem like this on my homework. You did. Okay, it may not look obvious, but you saw a problem exactly like this, or you will see a problem exactly like this on your homework. I think I am pretty positive I assigned this particular problem to you. And that is the yo-yo problem, because I like yo-yos, and I like toys, and I like playing with things. Right? So there is, if I take a string and a yo-yo, and let's say I wrap the string, I don't want to worry about multiple axes, I just wrap the string around the outside of this cylinder of radius r and treat it like a yo-yo and let it drop. What's its linear acceleration? Okay. What this thing is this is the ball rolling down the plane with tension, you know, with the force of friction. Here I've got this tension, which is exactly the same as that force of friction. So this thing is just the inclined plane ball with theta equals 90 degrees. Otherwise, it's the exact same thing. Okay? If I take my ball in my inclined plane, and I incline at 90 degrees, I've got a cylinder going down and unrolling and not slipping. Okay, here there's a string, here there's a force of friction, whatever it is. It's a force making the thing turn. But that also means that then you can go back to the class notes. You can use these class notes to do that problem in the homework, which is when you figured out this acceleration of this ball, okay, now use a cylinder here, 1/2 mr squared instead of 2/5 mr squared. You'll get a different acceleration down here, but all the math is here. All the problem is here for the yo-yo unwinding off of a string. It's exactly the same equations, exactly the same approach, except only the moment inertia is different. You got that? Yeah.
You don't have to break up the gravity.
Yeah, you don't, right. I mean, because if theta is equal to 90 degrees, right, mg sine theta is 0 and mg cosine theta is, you know, mg sine theta is 1 and mg cosine theta is 0. You got no normal force to worry about, no extra force of friction, etc. But, it, you know, it's just, other than that, though, the entire analysis is exactly the same. Okay. So, any questions on this stuff so far? Email me if you have problems on the homework. Generally, I'm around and awake until at least midnight or something like that. I don't know if you want to see me for your exam after class. Have a great rest of the week. Balsha will be here, and then Juwan will be heading up a review session next Wednesday, please.